This is one of those days when the intention of the people who picked these writings, I think, is fairly clear, at least in the instance of the first and third writing. They're talking about vocation, a call. And I would like to use the middle reading, the thing from 1 Corinthians, to fill in what is the absolutely fundamental call to which all of us are called, namely to our full humanity, to become human beings. That's what we're called to. We're called to become a baker, or a plumber, or a bus driver, or a university teacher, or anything else. You're called, we are all called to become a human being. And all that other stuff is simply in a further articulation of our humanity. So I'd like to take this passage from 1 Corinthians to examine particularly an aspect of our humanity which by and large the church, our church, and everybody else's churches, so far as I know, has done very badly with, namely the question of sexuality. Because the implication, often enough, as I've read this passage from Corinthians a couple of weeks ago, I said, oh my God, here we go. Here we go again. Paul the Blue Stocking, hitting on sex again. But I know Paul. I just finished a course in the letters of Paul. And I know that's not what he's after, but that's clearly the ears with which even I, at a fairly sophisticated level, still hear. Couple preliminary remarks. The first letter to the Corinthians is unique in the entire New Testament, really in the entire Bible, if you exclude that glorious, erotic, rhapsodic poem, which is the Song of Solomon in the Hebrew Bible, where it describes women's thighs and breasts in eminent and glorious detail. But it's the only place, the 6th and 7th chapters of 1 Corinthians, where sexuality is addressed directly. You can read all four Gospels, and Jesus never is depicted as talking about sex. This is not a major preoccupation for Jesus. He talks about relationships. He will talk about divorce, but we're not talking about genital activity. We're talking about relationships when we talk about that. And the fact that we hear it in terms of genitality just argues again to the same sort of weirdness and skewedness of at least my head, and that I know for sure of generations of Christians. Why does Paul talk about sex? Well, we're going to get to that in a minute, but there are a couple more preliminaries. First of all, Paul will regularly refer to the spirit warring against the flesh. And again, with our normal, untrained ears, we say, well, that's the better part of us, the higher part of us, warring against our lower natures. That's rubbish. That's simply not true. That's simply not what these texts say. Paul was a Jew. And being a Jew was a very different thing than being a Corinthian or being a Greek, and we'll have to get back to that. When Paul talked about the spirit warring against the flesh, the flesh, for him, just like the body in this passage here, refers to our full humanity, everything in us that resists God. And the spirit is the enlivening, empowering, humanizing activity of God. So sex doesn't even enter the picture, folks. Again, Jesus, the Jew, wasn't obsessed by sex as we seem to be. And now, the business of why Paul brought this up in the context of Corinth. The Jews had an extraordinarily different notion of how human beings were human than the Greeks did. For the Jews, to be a human was to be a breathing body. Literally. I mean, we see that in Genesis. God makes his little clay dummy, breathes into it, then it becomes a human being. The breath goes away, You don't have a human being. You have a corpse. You don't have a human being. You're only human when you are a breathing, animated body. It is, as the scholars say, a unitary view of human nature. The Greeks, on the other hand, going as far back to Socrates and probably before him, Plato, Aristotle, all the big names, had a dualistic view of human nature, where we had spirit as the immaterial and authentic part of ourselves. And the body is kind of like so much baggage. You may remember in one of the Platonic dialogues when Socrates is dying, he's all tickled because he says, death is like the bird being released from the cage. My spirit, my real self, will get out of all this garbage that I'm immersed in, this fleshiness. That has absolutely nothing to do with the Jewish view of human life. So Paul's talking to a bunch of moderately Greek sophisticates, certainly informed by Platonic, Aristotelian thought. It was just like the air they breathe. Stoic philosophy, Cynic philosophy. They were all further articulating to the same sort of thing, that the real self is this spiritual self, this inner self. And the body was kind of nugatory. The body was just sort of hanging around. Therefore, interestingly, in Corinth, they worked this out in two different directions. One of which was to say, well, the body is not really me, so it really doesn't matter what I do with my body. Therefore, you get sexual promiscuity. Prostitution was not illegal in the Roman Empire. It's normal. So it really didn't make any difference. On the other hand, in the same Corinthian community, you have people say, well, since my real self is this spiritual self, therefore, I have to deny the body. And so you have all these weird comments about Paul talking about people being married and yet refusing to have intercourse with each other. But note, it's from the same base that they articulate this in opposite directions. So what's Paul talking about here? He's not talking about this dualistic view of life. He's talking about the Corinthians being mucked up in their heads, where sexuality is basically dehumanized, depersonalized. Sex is not really part of the human, of the full humanity, of one's full humanity. That's his complaint. And if you read those two extraordinary chapters, as I said, unique in the entire Bible, he talks about virgins, he talks about being married, he talks about not being married. But what underlies that is his double problem with the single source, where people want to say, sexuality is not me. Well, the Jews say, yeah, sexuality is me. It is who I am. And therefore, contrary to the church I grew up in, which said, Trojak, you really ought to be ashamed because you have genitals. And I'm not exaggerating. And I know I was not unique in that. That sick bifurcation of me, which made me a quasi-human being as long as I had genitals. And that articulates all over the church. The angelism of the church, the elevation of celibacy in the church, the non-ordination of women, because as we all know, women are slightly less than human. They're earthy. So we dare not ordain them. They don't have penis, which are not earthy, as we all know. So we need desperately to somehow come up with a theology of bodiliness. There is a great Protestant theologian, James Nelson, who used this as his life project and wrote a half dozen splendid books on this subject.
chance. I don't know if he's still alive. I think most of the books are still in print. Wonderful. Wonderful treatises. Much better than anything Catholic. Remember, even the Pope took a year off on his allocutions about 3 or 4 years ago and talked about sex every week. But it was a sex that was odorless, without passion, without excitement. It was clinical sex. It was sex idealized, romanticized. It had little to do with people's real lives. Yeah? And all that stuff was collected into this book. But the tradition is ambiguous. As I thought about this more and more during the week, the tradition is ambiguous. Somebody just asked me yesterday, strangely enough, why they need a minister to get married. For the first 1,000 years of Christianity, you didn't need a minister to get married. Why? Because the ministers of the sacrament of marriage, as long as you're going to talk about marriage as a sacrament, are the husband and the wife. You don't need a minister. And for 1,000 years, they didn't have ministers. You get married in a closet, the two of you. And the only reason they stuck a priest in is to have a witness so people wouldn't practice bigamy or polygamy later on. That's the only reason. The ministers of the sacrament of marriage are the man and the wife. They give themselves, and that's sacramental. And you'll notice, even in the Roman Church, that marriage is not complete until it's not just ratum, officially announced, but consummatum, which means it takes on the full dimension of its humanity, its human reality, which is sexual. As long as a marriage is not physically consummated, and look at that language, my God, even I use that, this nice clinical, antiseptic, it's not physically consummated. The machinery didn't get turned on. Then you can get a divorce. But there is part of the wealth and the richness of the tradition that sex is precisely what makes human beings human. That they mediate themselves to each other. Now, can sexuality be a source of sin? Sure, folks. Let me give you an analogous example. Ordination to the priesthood. Can ordination to the priesthood be a source of sin? Oh, my God! Call Boston today. Call the Chancery office in Boston today and ask who's in charge. Or to take the letter of James. Is more stuff done by... Is more evil work by one's genitals or by one's tongue in this world? James says by one's tongue. Even the American bishops, in a somewhat infrequent moment of enlightenment, in their document on homosexuality, said that homophobia is a graver sin than any two homosexual men or women could do with each other. That's extraordinarily significant. That's extraordinary. And even there's the germ of this understanding that two people can give themselves to each other sexually. And it'd be humanizing. You know, we have denied that. Some of you, well, maybe you won't remember. But about 20 years ago, the American Catholic bishops got a bunch of theologians from Catholic University to do the most serious study on sexuality that had ever been undertaken. You can still get it second hand. I just ordered one. King's College Library has 2 or 3 copies in which they tried to rehabilitate this human understanding of sexuality, and the bishops in their wisdom ignored it. In a same way that the bishops of the United States, when they asked Andrew Greeley and a bunch of sociologists to talk, to examine the psychological maturity of the priesthood in the U.S. and found that most priests were seriously underdeveloped as human beings. Guess what happened to that report? Unacknowledged, unaccepted. It's the most authentic kind of documentation on this subject that we've ever had. You may remember several weeks ago when we were still using the Anglican hymnal, there was this phrase. I picked out this hymn because I'd like the tune, and then I found myself, "And we thank you for the sacrament of sex." I joked. Those words came out of the project. What did you just say? By God, you said the right thing. We all sang the right thing. The right thing. You know? Imagine, I can vividly recall trying to crawl out from under my mother and the nuns and the training I had, which caused me to hate my body, because simply it was my body, with genitals attached. I remember making Willax. We were big in the seminary on Willax. You know, you make Willax. I went to the chaplain and said, "God, here I am, penis and all." It was a moment of liberation. Small liberation. But it doesn't just happen. Here I am. This is who I am. So, the implications of this, personally, I think are enormous. The implications of this for the church are massive, monumental. We cannot ordain married men. Yet the church did for 1,000 years. The Eastern churches, as everybody knows, still do. Certainly we cannot ordain women. Why? On this little broadcast on the 2.5 hours that they did on the Pope, they had a scene of a statue of this traveling Lady of Fatima statue. There are dozens of them, and they seem to be always on the road someplace. And they were talking about the Pope, who believed when he was shot, and they quote him, that Mary didn't want me to die because she is really going to keep me going. And if you know his coat of arms, he has a great big hairy M on a field of blue. And it doesn't stand for mother or me. It stands for Mary. And he said, in that context, that it had a mental lapse, that Mary was protecting him, and Jesus, this is the line, Jesus doesn't want women priests because he didn't ordain Mary a priest. Folks, I'm sorry, but that's brain dead. Jesus didn't ordain anybody a priest. Any scripture scholar, Catholic, Protestant, or anything else, will tell you. But that remark is important as a kind of heuristic device to see how profound and thoroughgoing this bifurcation of human beings is at every level in the history of the church. Every level. Every level. I have not outgrown it. Nor have I outgrown that shadowy doctrine that we were all taught in moral theology, and in every other area, whether slander, theft, you know, eating meat on Friday, you can eat 2 ounces, that's a venial sin, 2.5 ounces, that's mortal sin, you're hell-bent. Except when it comes to sex, non datur parvitas materiae. There is no little bitty sex sin. They're all humongous. They're all mortal. So you had seminaries where guys had to use paddles to stick their shirts in their trousers. List.
Mm-hmm.
You had convents where women had to shower wearing robes. And of course, by canon law, women's bodies, if they were religious, vowed religious, virginal women, they had to have costumes which would disguise the fact that they had breasts. So if you've ever wondered why those nuns in the old days were just burdened with yards and yards and yards of seemingly useless material, that's the reason. That's the reason. My sister congregation, their expedient was to create little bibs or capes. You know. What's wrong with us? Is sex dangerous? Yeah. Is having a tongue dangerous? Yeah. Is having eyes dangerous? Yeah. Ears? Yeah. A nose? Yeah, even having a nose can be dangerous. Hands, feet. They can all be dangerous. But we only become human in accepting the fullness of our reality. We only become what God calls us to be by becoming fully accepting of who we are and who everybody else is, and that means accepting our own sexuality. Everybody else's as well. That's what God said. God looked at the world and it was good. Despite our moronic resistance.